You are listening to the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast, the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Here's your host, Tyus France.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast. We are the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Today is April 22nd. It is episode number 4, so we're still just getting started. We really appreciate you being an early adopter of the podcast. It means a lot to us, and I just bit my tongue. So the rest of this podcast is going to be done with me talking with a bit tongue. Great. Sitting across from me is my co-host, Alex Zier.
Hey, everyone.
Thanks for being here again. Appreciate you. Last I saw you was at the Italian gathering. What's the Italian place?
It's the Siena Trattoria.
Siena Trattoria. And we had a really nice gathering of like-minded people there for one of our little social events.
Yeah, it's always a lot of fun to come out to our socials. So shameless plug, go to lpnevada.org/events and you can see all of the socials. We have three up in the north part of the state near Reno and Washoe County, and we have two going down here in Las Vegas with a third to start in May.
That's awesome. We're getting a third? Oh, there's so much to come.
In North Las Vegas.
Always good times. Now, I also heard right before this, you said that there was a new group forming or a new...
Oh, that's right. Yes. So recently, and by recently I mean over the last couple of months, a new caucus formed at the national level called the Libertarian Pragmatist Caucus. And basically their goal is to help candidates get elected. So provide voter resources, provide a bank of people that know how to do graphic design, website design, know how to do public relations, put out press releases. In other words, put together the winning group of people that can help a local candidate run for office in 2018. So, you know, we pride ourselves on focusing on bringing together that talent, those unique talents together that you know, achieve a winning race.
Okay, help me out. What's a caucus mean?
So a caucus is basically a fancy way of saying
a great word.
Group of people. It is a great word, especially if you're me, because, you know, I love the caucus.
Oh, there it goes. There we go.
But, yeah, I had to just put it out there. This is explicit, so sure. Who gives a fuck?
But we can say anything we want, as we should be able to.
Yes, so fuck you.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. I take that with all the love and respect I think it garners.
Oh, yeah. I love that word. There's a great YouTube clip on that, too. We should watch that sometime. But anyway... So this new group is just a group of people who are not necessarily tired of the way the Libertarian Party is heading, although certainly there is some of that. It's more about helping to bring together the people who want to win a local office, win a state assembly race, win a state Senate race. So, you know, at least initially, we're not going to be focused on trying to court or run governors or U.S. senators or anything like that. You know, I think that there's so much to be done in each backyard of a state. So, you know, we had a meeting this morning, in fact, where I trained a couple people on Nation Builder, which is a really great tool. It's one that's used pretty widely in politics and particularly in the Libertarian Party. And it's a customer relations manager, which is great. So long story short, we're already starting to provide some hands-on interactive training for people and kind of put them in touch so that in 2018, when we endorse as a caucus, when we endorse a candidate, that doesn't just mean, you know, you got our vote, right? It means we're going to provide you with a group of people that can work on your graphic design, a group of people that can work on your website, and some other things like that. We're not a platform-focused caucus, and that's something that's different than, I think, a lot of the caucuses that are in the Libertarian Party. They're very platform-focused. There's certain planks in the platform that they'd like to see changed. There's certain bylaws that they'd like to see adopted. About as internal politic as we get is that we will endorse people as body for the Libertarian National Committee. But our goal is not to run a slate of candidates that, you know, take over or anything. And again, that's something that...
What is the goal then?
So the goal is to elect pragmatic libertarians to public office. And that's the principal goal, with a secondary goal of helping the party have an infusion of new ideas and stuff by endorsing both incumbents and also newcomers to the races for the Libertarian National Committee. But again, that's merely so that we can have a say, not the say, but a say in some of the ways that money is spent and some of the ideas that are promoted. Like, for example, last week was the LNC's quarterly meeting. And
LNC stands for?
The Libertarian National Committee, yes. And they met to discuss a number of issues, but one of which was marketing. And everyone can agree, the Libertarian Party's marketing could use some assistance. And nobody's disputing that, but just like in a real Congress, right, you have different groups of people who want to see it done differently. And so, the LNC, I think, made a good decision in saying that the proposal that was presented was not good enough. But at the same time, you know, it's good to see that there are people open to finding some experts that are willing to work with us and provide marketing direction and assistance, because that's not a very easy
sure
thing to do. And you know, at the national level, we're serious. If we want to be continued to see as a serious contender, one worthy of making it onto a debate stage, then we have to continue putting out high-level campaign quality graphics, images, press releases, social media statements, you know, not just ballot access. In other words, we've grown out of the just doing ballot access, and that's our big goal. Obviously, that's a goal of every political party, is to be on the ballot, but that's no longer just the main goal, right? Get people on the ballot. Now it's like, let's get people fucking elected. So I think that this is something that's starting to happen in every state and in every LP affiliate, where you've got a group of people now who were able to work together either for a local race or on the Gary Johnson campaign. And they were like, you know what? You know, we only got 3.5% to 4%, but that's 3.5% to fucking 4% as a third party in America. That's a historic result, regardless. I mean, in our entire nation's history, it's a historic result. And it means that 3 or 4 voters out of every 100 stood in line to vote for Gary Johnson. Mm-hmm. And when you put it like that, I mean, and you think about how small a group of 100 people is, you know, and then you start to realize that we have something here. And if we want to capitalize on that in 2020, then it starts with focusing on running good candidates at the local level in 2018 so that people can see us win. Because one of the biggest arguments you always hear of, you know, about libertarians is, well, they just, you know, they just never win. And I don't want to throw my vote away. Mm-hmm. Well, as much as we can refute that argument any number of ways, I think the best way to refute that argument is just to fucking win. I mean, right? Like,
so like rather than actually give all of the logical arguments, just be like, yeah, I guess we should just win one, huh?
Yeah. And how different do you think that the laws would be if every single state lower house, except for the unicameral ones, but I mean, if every single state lower house had just one libertarian legislator, you don't think that'd make a big difference?
It'd be tremendous. But I think a lot of the time people only focus on the federal level. Mm-hmm. And while the local level actually should have more impact on their life, and it's something that they can impact on a greater level, right? They have a greater influence on that local government. So maybe that's where the wins need to at least originate from, so that we can say, if we get into that, once we get into that federal arena, right? That person then has the support from all of these local arenas too, and that's not to say they won't have people on opposite sides, but they'll at least have a base that they can use for support on a local area, which I think that would be a huge win.
Absolutely, it would. It's just that, you know, when you talk about the concentration of people, money, and resources for, say, a U.S. Senate race, we're talking millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases.
Wow.
That's more than the Gary Johnson campaign raised in some cases. And they raised a lot of money.
It's a little disgusting that that's what it has to get to be able to run for these public officials. Like, these jobs do not pay that much.
Right.
They should not justify that.
I mean, so, like, for example, here in Nevada, right, we want to win a state assembly race. That race normally, for a normal district, sees about a $40,000 outlay. which is the same as the Senate race in a way, because Senate races, and again, I'm talking about the Nevada State Senate, are every 4 years, and they're about 80. But now they're starting to etch up more to closer to 100. Although I think that was probably due to a couple outliers that spent on the almost $1 million on their state Senate race. Yeah, and they only get a per diem. They don't even get a salary here. It is all about the fact that they control such a huge amount of money for other people when they pass laws. Imagine how much more money would be brought into Las Vegas if we could start selling marijuana now. Not 9 months from now. Now.
You can, but it's just you might go to prison.
Exactly. Regulation is standing in the way. And I think that was something that you wanted to talk about today is how, again, how the state and local government can stand in the way of their own business success.
Yeah.
You can't fight unemployment and give everyone the perfectly paying job.
Yeah.
You just can't do both of those because there's only so much money being generated, and that money goes to labor sources. And if you want everyone to have a job, everyone's going to make less.
Yeah.
And if everyone makes less, people are going to do less, work hard, less hard, and eventually you've turned yourself into Soviet Russia.
So I'll make that transition so that people understand what we're talking about there. Online on Facebook, I've been getting into some debates on a fairly regular basis, and I've decided that every week, I think I'm just going to bring up the topic that I'm likely going to talk about in the podcast. So this week, I asked the question, what should the minimum wage be? And I made it a multiple choice question. One of those options was zero. One of those options, I believe, was like $1,000. And then we had some stuff in between, eight, 15, so forth. So I wanted people to just kind of ring in on their answers, see where everybody was at. I was shocked. I was really quite surprised at how many people did not vote for zero. Not surprised that not a single person said $1,000. So we had, I think, two or three people that said, like, you shouldn't have a minimum wage, which to me makes a lot of sense. And we're going to go into a lot of the reasons behind that. I think the first person that did vote and say, or did say it should be no money at all, there should not be a minimum wage, was one of the people that work with us. So she chimed in. So anyways, let's talk a little bit about the history of minimum wage. And I was surprised to find out, after doing just a little bit of research, that minimum wage was enacted not to try and protect workers, but actually to make them unemployed. So it was originally created not in the United States, actually. It was an idea that happened outside of the U.S. to begin with, but it was there to prevent women, the disabled, and what they, quote, said, undesirable races from taking people's jobs. So what they would do is they'd say, you know what, these people from China will work for such a low amount that they could come in and take all of our jobs. The best way for us to prevent that is to raise the rate so that they can't undercut us. They can't take our jobs from out from underneath us. It was something that was designed actually to hurt poor people rather than help poor people. And that's its initial origin. Everybody that was, or not everybody, a lot of people online that was arguing with me was saying, well, it's all about making sure that people have a basic level of income that they can support their life with. And my thought process on this is that you are actually taking away the one thing that somebody who's very poor can use to compete against somebody that has a lot of resources. So if I have a lot of skills, which I'm very, very proud to tell you I do. So if I've got a lot of skills and somebody doesn't, the way they could compete with me without, they might not have the resources to go out and learn technology and public speaking and all these different skill sets that you might have over time. They might not have that ability, but what they could do is they could undercut me. And you might say, well, that sounds terrible, but that's capitalism. Like that's the fair market. And if somebody wants to hire somebody that is willing to offer to do the work, not necessarily as well, but for significantly less, well, then they can compete against me. And in that process, they'd probably learn the skills and on-the-job training to become a more lucrative and valuable employee in the future. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Anyways, taking away the this minimum wage thing, taking away no minimum wage, making sure that you force people to have a wage that is, I guess they're saying the term livable, but that's completely subjective. Anything could be considered a livable wage. If the argument is $15 is the livable wage, then why not be $1,000? Why not be $1,000,000? And if you can then say, like, well, it's ludicrous to say $1,000,000 is what everybody should be paid, well, couldn't you work backward from that and say, well, $100 is then two, and probably $15 is two? The only way of making it really fair is that each person can compete on their own merits, not based off of what the livable wage should be in their area, but by the value that they bring to the job that they're applying for. It should be a voluntary agreement. The base price of employment should be based around what an employer is willing to pay and what an employee is willing to accept. And in that sense, both sides are voluntary. But if you force either side to work outside of that agreement, if you are forcing somebody to work for less than they want to work for, or if you are forcing somebody to pay somebody for more than they agree to be paid, you are now trampling across their rights of having freedom. Yes?
Absolutely. And something that I like to tell people, and I think I might have mentioned this last week as well, but it's, I think it bears repeating, is that the wage in the market, the free labor market, is determined by the minimum amount of money that it motivates someone to get up off their chair and go do it. So, for example, I hired a guy to do some landscaping for me this morning. I mean, for as much work as he did in those few hours, I would have had to charge like $1,000, because it would have taken me a long time. It would have been very difficult work for me to figure out how to do that. He just knew from his many years of experience and that sort of thing. So his experience and his tools allowed him to actually charge a cheaper price than ever I could for the same amount of time. And, you know, he came out, you know, after we did a little bit of negotiating and that sort of thing, he came out for the minimum amount of money that he would be willing to come out there and do that work. That's why he came out. I mean, if he would have taken $500, that's what I'd offered him. But, you know, of course, right? You'd always take more money. But when we're negotiating a price and we're haggling over, you know, what it should be, he will come out and do that landscaping service for a minimum amount. And when we found that minimum amount, you know, through negotiation, he was able to come out and take care of that landscaping. And it's true for every job. I mean, I like what I do. I like being a software engineer, and money is not the only thing that I factor in. Benefits matters. You know, how good the work environment matters, how my relationship with my boss matters. All of those things matter to an employee. So that, taken together with the compensation, that arrangement that you, it's unique for every person. Some people don't care. They could have a bitch boss and they don't give a fuck. But some people do care, and that matters, and that they'd rather work for less pay somewhere with a really nice work environment than for more pay at a sweatshop style coding environment or something.
Sure.
And that's what it is, right? You're trying to find what that minimum amount is, and it's different for everybody. So people are going to be drawn to different areas. So it's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous to say to somebody, you're willing to clean my house for the equivalent of $4 an hour profit. That's not enough to motivate me. For me, I won't do anything for less than $10 an hour profit or enjoyment.
Sure.
But, and I think you even mentioned there was an app or something that would determine how much you should charge or how much your time's worth per hour or something like that.
Oh, there probably, I don't remember that, but yes, there's probably a few.
Yeah.
There's easy ways to calculate that. But let's take the idea, the thought of this outside of employment, because that's a very personal situation, right? If you were to take it and say, we're making shoelaces, right? A lot of people argue that if you have no minimum wage, then it's going to be a race to the bottom, because it's going to be just companies offering the least amount as possible all the time, and everyone's going to be fighting to get to the, until everybody's paid nothing. But let's take it to a different degree. Let's say we make shoelaces, but because of some government regulation, we are now, nobody is allowed to buy a shoelace for less than $15, right? We are, they're forced to pay $15 no matter what the shoelace is. Our incentive in making shoelaces is to make the worst shoelace possible, because we know we're going to make $15 on each shoelace. We have no incentive to make a great shoelace and try and win over the market. The market's already being forced to pay more than that person is worth. So as a manufacturer, I'm incentivized to do the worst job possible. Similarly, if I am a minimum wage employee, I'm not incentivized to do better work. I'm not incentivized, if I'm actually worth $8 an hour and I'm making $15 because they're forced to pay me $15 an hour, I'm really not incentivized to do more. I'm incentivized as much to do $8 as I am to do $7 or $1 worth of labor as I am to do $14 worth of labor, and they're forced to pay more than I'm worth in every situation.
Absolutely. And if you look at people who are so excited when they get that 25-cent raise, which seems like tiny to a lot of people, but think about, you're making $7 an hour, let's say, and you get a pay raise of $7.75. That's a lot of extra money for you over the course of a 40-hour work week. That's huge. You're fighting for that 75 cents. That 75 cents matters to you. But as Tyus was saying, if you're already making 15, and the minimum you would be willing to do that job for is 7, and you have no incentive to fight your way up to 16 because you didn't have to fight your way up to 7.75, then 8.25, then hit, you know, a crew member, you know, manager, a lot of fast food places where you're, you know, kind of running a section, and then you'll move on, and now you're running the floor, but only at night. You know what I mean? You have no incentive to work your way up to a higher than 15. Because the different, there's no increment. There's not an incremental increase, right? To get to 16 from 15 requires that you do if you were willing to do it for $7, like we were just saying, and you're getting paid 15, you have to more than double what you'd be willing to do for that job in order to hit even 15, let alone that next amount of pay.
Yeah, you might as well work less.
Yeah, so if you're willing to do that job for $7 an hour, you're honestly not incentivized to get to 15 until, you know, there's almost no incentive to get up there. It's over twice what you'd be willing to do that job for.
But
in a normal environment.
It makes sense then on why so many people push for having a higher minimum wage. If I am being paid under what the minimum wage is, then the easiest way for me to get a raise is not to increase my output and my production.
Yep.
My easiest way for me to increase my pay is to force the employer to pay more. It makes sense why there's motives there. It's just backwards.
It makes so much sense from an employee side until you realize that the input cost, right? And this is something that every business will look at. One of the variable input costs is going to be labor.
One of the biggest.
And yes, and it's substantial. I mean, just look at how much the federal government spends on employees every year. It boggles the mind. And regardless of whether it's defense or healthcare or health and human services or whatever, I mean, it's just...
It's almost always the biggest. It's cost of goods and labor. That's it.
Yeah, and cost of goods nowadays is just... I mean, as long as we don't do any of these stupid tariffs and all this sort of thing, but...
Cost of goods could be very, very cheap, and labor could go up in value if everybody was employed. But the truth is, we're running into a situation where there's greater and greater unemployment, and you'd think, well, how do we fix it? Well, employers are going toward automation. The reason they're going toward automation is it costs, let's say the upfront cost on automation is going to be significant. It's probably not going to be as significant as paying a person for the entire year. A good friend of mine makes vending machines and slot machines and all kinds, basically anything out of metal, makes them. And he has a huge order where he's making these teller machines for fast food restaurants so that they don't have to pay people to take your money or take your order. You suddenly become responsible for that. Well, they don't have to pay that employee anymore. That person's removed. If you've gone to a grocery store, you've probably noticed that self-checkout is a bigger and bigger thing. The reasons behind that is not because self-checkout is necessarily better or faster. It is that ultimately it is cheaper, and as we push that minimum wage up, we are incentivizing employers to to fire their employees. Their employees are not worth the time that they have to spend on them. Or the money they have to spend on them.
It's interesting that you bring up grocery stores because they have one of the thinnest margins of any business, something like 2.5% profit margin. I mean, it's just teeny tiny, and they're always looking for ways to offer customers lower prices without necessarily paying their workers less because then they won't have good workers. So automation is the natural solution. You can keep the workers you do have that are good the best. And you can pay them a little more even. And unfortunately, you have to let go of the people who aren't as productive, aren't as good, not as knowledgeable, always having to look up what that fruit, you know, number is. They don't just know it. You know, you have no incentive to hire those people. And it, and so things like becoming a grocery store bagger is no longer an entry-level job, right? It's done only by the people who are honestly the very best baggers, the ones that get, you know, five-star reviews, so to speak. Those, I mean, and yeah, that might sound great until you are bagging your own groceries because it's all automated.
Yeah.
And after 10 p.m., they don't have any employees, just one manager, couple stockers, not like the bad kind, the ones that puts food on shelves. Although, hopefully...
Who's to say those are the bad kind anyways? Like, they could all be good stockers. I love a good stalker occasionally.
Yeah?
Good stalkers. Ones that love me without reciprocation. You know?
Oh.
So, if... I'll move off of that one.
Yeah, that's too funny, though.
So, if we want greater employment, the trick is to actually lower the minimum wage, because that person that only, let's say I only have the skill set to generate $3 per hour worth of output. If that's all I can do, I'm pretty much out of luck. I can't get a job in the United States right now. However, if you were to say, you know what, I'll let you have a job as kind of an intern, I'll pay you your $3 an hour. You can come in, you'll learn. Yes, you're not producing very much, but it's not costing me very much to hire you. I'd be happy to hire you because you don't cost anything. And then as your skill set grows, great, now I have somebody, I can give you a raise and you're suddenly valuable to me. If you want to increase employment, you lower the cost of entry into that so that people can compete. On the other hand, if you do want to increase the minimum wage, here's what ends up happening. If you were to give everybody $15 an hour, $30 an hour, $1,000 an hour, all that does is it changes the floor. So if that becomes the base pay, then skilled labor has to be paid more than that. So the only way to justify this across the board is you increase what you pay everybody else, but to justify the increased pay, you've got to increase the price of goods. So the apple that cost pennies suddenly costs dollars. And now that apple that costs so much more is still out of price range for that poor person to purchase. So it doesn't fix the problem at all. Now that the apple's out of range for them to purchase, they're going to be begging for an increase in the minimum wage again. And it just becomes an endless cycle. It's where Keynesian economics is just going to always fail, and Austrian economics is going to work. You succeed by letting the market be free and fair.
Absolutely. And interesting that you mentioned food again, because that's one of the areas where, I mean, people are so angry that it should be anyone in America, the land of plenty, where most of us could stand to lose 20 or 30 pounds, if anything. And for me, more like 50. But, that anyone should go hungry here. And one of the biggest reasons people go hungry here is because the cost of food has been artificially inflated. Because of farm subsidies, we pay millions of dollars. Just dumb. How dumb is this? We pay producers millions of dollars to dump milk on the ground, to burn their crops, to plant them but burn them. I mean, it's just silly. It's not part of let's make sure that we have a grain reserve or whatever. It's not part of anything like that. They're burning it. They're not putting it in a warehouse. They're burning it to the ground. They're dumping it on the ground. And it's really just become a government jobs program in agriculture.
Yeah, we're manipulating markets across the board, whether that is like we're subsidizing corn and cattle, or we're hurting companies that use preservatives. Like across the board, it's an area that we don't have to meddle in. And in the same way, we don't have to meddle in employment. We've seen that when you give people a fair chance, they rise to the occasion. And the truth is, those who choose not to rise to the occasion have done that then by choice, not by force, because they have an opportunity. They're not being forced out of the market by a rate that is just too high. Let's start wrapping it up. But before we do, let's talk. We got a couple of events taking place. We've got a day of action happening. Well, actually, it's happening today. It already happened.
Tomorrow.
Well, yes, but we're releasing this tomorrow.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Think of us as we're traveling through a time machine of some kind. The event has already taken place. So, hey, if you showed up to the day of action this morning, we appreciate you.
Yes, thank you so much, because it's people like you that are going to help make us able to win districts in 2018.
Yes, that's awesome. The truth is, we're going to need everybody. If you have even a small interest in getting involved, please get involved. The easiest way, if you're wanting to get involved, obviously go to the website, right? Show up at some of these socials. We do these socials. They're not there for us to give a speech or anything like that. They're an opportunity for you to say, hey, I'm interested. And if you are, that's a great place to meet everybody that you might want to talk to about it and offer your services in the way that you want to. For me, I've already done podcasts for years. I went to the very first mixer I ever had and I said, hey, this is something that I can do. Would you guys be interested? And they said, yes, let's do it. For you, it may be, hey, I want to run for office in this area. Hey, I'm great at publishing. We can use your help. So please show up, get involved. We'd love to have you. There's also a really, really interesting thing that I kind of wanted to ask you about. The diplomatic mission to Malaysia?
You know, I actually don't know much about that.
Okay, fair enough.
That's a Northern Nevada thing. And there's apparently a sovereign nation of Malaysia, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce
it. It's the Republic of Malaysia, I believe, or it might be Malaysia. I don't know. I honestly don't know much about it, but I do know that our vice chair and several of the people up in the Reno area are going to go travel to that, and it's actually in Nevada. It's a sovereign nation within Nevada that they're going to actually try to establish some diplomatic relations with.
That is awesome. I didn't even know that there was any sovereign nations in the U.S. because I didn't know the U.S. was giving any sovereign land. But
cool. And I guess they're part of the U.S., but like on a territory. It's very strange to me how this works, but I believe it's similar to how the Native American.
Okay.
They have their sovereign land, still part of the U.S., but you know, not necessarily. They're like between the federal and state. You know, just like a territory, if you will.
Cool.
So,
well, that is happening in a week from today. So if you are up in that area, that's going to be at 10 a.m. So please go to the website, check out all the details, and you can find more information there. Alex, if people want to reach out to you, where should they go?
Best place is to message me on Facebook at facebook.com/alexmd.liberty.
Wonderful. If you want to find me, you can track me down at my website, tyusfrance.com, or Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Tyus France. You can email me or the podcast at podcast@lpnevada.org. And please head over to lpnevada.org, where you can find all of the events, everything we've got going on, and really how you can get involved. We'd love to see you there. Please leave us a positive review online, as the podcast is new and we'd appreciate it. Until next time, make it all about freedom.
This show is brought to you by the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Music is provided by T. Sims. Please support the show by subscribing, sharing it with friends, and leaving a positive review on iTunes. For more information or to learn how to get involved, visit lpnevada.org. Thank you for listening.